Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Hygge Nurse Podcast. I am your host, Rachel Zimmer. And today I had the pleasure of introducing a dear friend and brilliant colleague of mine, Dr. Mia Yang. Dr. Mia is a geriatrician, which means that she is a physician who specializes in the care of older adults, and she works at Atrium Health Wake Forest Baptist in internal medicine and geriatrics. She has a wealth of experience in caring for older adults who have dementia and working closely with their care partners. Additionally, she has her own podcast, and it's called Ask Dr. Mia, which focuses on aging well and the many facets of geriatric medicine, focusing significantly on dementia and caregiver well-being. And if you are a caregiver of someone who has dementia, I really encourage you to listen to her podcast because she has a ton of great advice. It's not every day that you get to listen to a geriatrician tell you things that might be helpful for your care. So today on the podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about caregiver well-being. We're also going to talk about a study that she and I have led together. And what we did was we wanted to know about the well-being of Black and Latino caregivers in the community, specifically caregivers of people who have dementia. So we're going to talk a little bit about the study, but we also talk a lot about some tips around caregiving for someone who might have dementia or chronic illness. So this could be a really good, helpful episode for you if you are one of the people who are caregivers of people who have a chronic illness. So snuggle up, get a blanket, get some coffee or tea, something warm to drink, and enjoy the show.
A really great friend of mine, Dr. Mia Yang. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. Hi, Rachel. And I am Dr. Mia. I am a geriatrician, one of Rachel's colleagues at Atrium Health Wake Forest Baptist in internal medicine and geriatrics. As a geriatrician, I have been taking care of patients in a number of different settings, and I also do research in dementia care. So dealing a lot with patients with cognitive impairment as well as their caregivers. And I also have my own podcast called Ask Dr. Mia. And it is a podcast about aging well, as well as kind of the sides of geriatric medicine that I oftentimes talk about in my clinic, and wanted to spread that knowledge to everyone. So thank you for having me.
Yeah. I'm going to put Dr. Mia's show in the show notes. I actually listened to it to myself, and it's very helpful. So thanks for pointing that out. And I actually wanted to ask you to just step back for a second and talk a little bit about like how you ended up doing what you do clinically. Like what inspired you to go into the medical field and then also specifically geriatrics?
Yeah, great question. My origin story. I think it does circle back to my childhood. So I was born in China and have lived in China until I was 12, mainly brought up by my grandparents. So I have always loved older adults. I think I was a precocious child who enjoyed talking with older adults more than perhaps kids my age. And I knew I wanted to do something related to healthcare, but throughout training, I think I was a late differentiator. I liked everything and then kind of forced to pick something. But I ended up picking internal medicine because I like people who have a story. I like complicated patients. And then when it came time to potentially subspecialize, I really had a challenging time deciding how much I wanted to be a primary care doctor and how much I wanted to be a specialist. And I was fortunate to train at Johns Hopkins Bayview, which had and still has a very strong geriatric presence. And that's where the Hopkins Geriatrics Department is based out of. So my training had great role models who are geriatricians. And I decided that it was a great way for me to do a little bit of both in terms of both primary care and, you know, getting that relationship with my patients and families throughout, you know, the last stage of their life, as well as being a specialist. And I think fellowship is really when I further specialize into the cognitive domain. And that kind of led to where I am now, where I do a little bit of everything in terms of research and clinical care. And my first love was home-based primary care, where Rachel and I have shared patients and work alongside each other for a number of years since I started coming to Wake Forest. And I think ultimately some of my most impressionable patients are patients that I've taken care of at home mm-hmm. who happen to also have dementia. And I think the daily loving and care that their family members put towards those relationships have really inspired me to do the work that I do now to kind of make the healthcare system easier and better for people who are really doing uncompensated 24/7 type of work that is incredibly challenging.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't know if I've actually specifically said this on the podcast, but one of the reasons that I started my business, Huga, about on the side was because I've been in so many homes and have seen the impacts that a home environment can have on people. And also because we have focused a lot of our work on well-being, especially from a caregiver perspective, and how can we as clinicians or medical providers, but also as systems of care, help improve well-being for caregivers. And so that's something I wanted to talk to you a little bit about today. I know some of our research is centered on that too. And so I wanted to just ask, you know, some of the, you know, thoughts that you had around some of the most common challenges that you're seeing right now when it comes to a caregiver. And when we're defining a caregiver, maybe we should step back and say, you know, what is a caregiver? And then, you know, what are some of the challenges we might see as we're approaching their care?
Yeah, I think that the term caregiver is difficult to define depending mm-hmm. on for what purpose. In general, I think of a caregiver as someone who is assisting another person in either their daily life or in their relationship with the healthcare system. So, for example, I am sort of a caregiver for my mother, even though I don't live with her, but I handle mainly interface with her with her medical professionals. And she has metastatic cancer. She doesn't have dementia. But a lot of times I find that adult children may or may not see themselves as a caregiver, because I think sometimes there is a connotation that caregiving implies there is some sort of hands-on assistance. And there are also people who really don't like the word caregiver and much would prefer the word care partner, in that they are partnering with the person who may have cognitive impairment to give more autonomy and power back to the person who is receiving the care. And then there's the whole, you know, paid versus unpaid caregivers. And I think, you know, spousal versus people who are family but not spouse, and people who live immediately in the city versus people who are farther away. Like any other role, I think there's quite a lot of variable and multiple intersections of identities related to that word caregiver.
That's a complicated word.
Yeah.
Not to mention children.
Right.
We didn't even bring that one up. So yeah, so in the context that we're talking about today, that's really, you know, what we're talking about. And so when I'm asking about challenges, I would, you know, I know I've seen many challenges that caregivers have had over the years when it comes to even just being able to take time for themselves, to even feel that they can take time for themselves appropriately. So what are your thoughts just about some of the things that you've seen when you're talking to other caregivers?
Yeah, so I think you know, if I'm understanding your earlier statement correctly, I think we're specifically talking about people who are family members or close friends who are helping people in sort of navigating either the healthcare system or something related to their daily life. And challenges, I think there are plenty, but in my mind, I think of them sort of as three big buckets, and they're overlapping with each other. One bucket is certainly in terms of the caregiver self-care. So how could the person who is caring for someone else take time for themselves so that they're buckets are filled to be able to then pour into someone else. That's certainly one that I have challenges with myself. And then there's another bucket kind of related to the care recipient, which is really, you know, what's going on with the person who is receiving the care, especially if you live far away or that you don't understand something about their medical conditions or that, you know, it has to do with how the person who is receiving the care in terms of their attitudes and relationships and preferences. And then the third bucket, I think it's really about the healthcare system and how to know who to go to or what typically happens in terms of particularly transitions of care, going from home to hospital or rehab or assisted living or long-term care, hospice. And I think that's where, for me, in my training, I felt like geriatric fellowship was very helpful in terms of thinking about the different system level issues that were perhaps not as emphasized in my internal medicine training. And it is a lot of kind of trial and error for people who are not in the medical field to figure it out. So those three, I think those are the three main buckets, sort of self, the person you're caring for, and the system at large.
Yeah, I'm glad you broke it down like that. And, you know, I think sometimes the hardest one for us to help navigate, at least from, you know, what can we change perspective, is the system. And that can feel very difficult. And I think sometimes we'll find ourselves as partners partnering with the caregiver to help them navigate, you know, a very difficult health system together. But, you know, I do think that there are things that we have done, especially as a house call team over the last 10 years that I've been a part of the house call team, that we've, you know, really strategized around, like, how do we support caregivers and what are things, even from an institutional level, you know, I think about the memory counseling program, right, and how they're wrapping around care and counseling for caregivers. And there's a lot of self-care strategies that could be gained, I think, from interfacing with something like a memory counseling program, but not every health system has such a thing. So we're kind of special in that. So what are some strategies that you have heard or talked to caregivers about from that sort of perspective, from the self-care and even like the behavioral management for people who have dementia?
Yeah, I think this is the piece where I would say so much of what we do is reflected by what we think internally. And a lot of times when we encounter challenges and frustrations, sometimes there may be both a knowledge issue of not knowing what to do, as well as sort of an emotional side where you're blaming yourself or feeling guilty about something that you feel like you should have done or could have done. And I think those are two related but separate issues that most people kind of think of as one. And then I see a lot of times people kind of beat themselves up about it because they feel like, you know, if I could have done something or did something different, then perhaps the person I'm caring for is not in the hospital or does not have to go to the emergency room. And I think that's where in some of the most difficult cases, I think it is helpful to sort out for the caregiver themselves, you know, what kind of things are internal thoughts versus, you know, external restrictions. So, you know, for example, just using my own mother as an example, you know, she was having really difficult to control fluids in her belly from her ovarian cancer. And as her daughter, who is also a doctor, but not living in the same city as her, it was very difficult and somewhat frustrating for her to, you know, continually needing to go to the emergency room or potentially to be hospitalized. And what was happening was that her fluid buildup was happening so fast that either she couldn't wait until there is a outpatient scheduled paracentesis with interventional radiology where they can, you know, remove several liters of fluid at one time, or that she would go for one of those appointments to remove fluid and then they see on the ultrasound that she doesn't actually have enough fluid. Mm-hmm. So I think in those cases, it's me knowing what are the capabilities of what an emergency room can do for her versus what interventional radiology can do versus what sometimes it has to be a hospitalization that allows her to get the relief from draining multiple liters of fluid, even though, you know, as a geriatrician, I think, you know, if only her IR department could schedule her in at X, Y, and time, then she wouldn't have to go. But I also know that that's not something within my control, and it's not something within her control, and it's even not something within her oncologist's control.
Right.
But it's just a system kind of not operating in a way that she can get the care that she needs at the time that she needs it. So for some people, you know, who may not have that knowledge, they may be blaming themselves or get frustrated at themselves or their loved ones for kind of escalation of their care as a result of their disease process. And I think there could be a lot of unnecessary self-blame going on. So one of the strategies, I think, whether it's through formal therapy or even just through journaling that I think is really helpful is trying to tease out your self-awareness of what you're thinking. Sometimes, you know, the feeling that you have is just a overwhelming sense of either overwhelm or frustration. And it would be great if you have someone in your life who can talk through the issues with you. But if you don't have someone, I think we always have the power and the option to journal. And so, for example, Elizabeth Gilbert, who is the author who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, she has an exercise called Letters to Love, which you can sign up on her Substack for like $5 a month. But basically, mm-hmm. the principle is where you write a letter to love, and love is what Elizabeth deems as, you know, something, an entity that's within all of us, whether you believe it's God or a higher being, it really doesn't matter. But Letters to Love is, I think, a very helpful exercise that I've done personally and have suggested to some of my friends as well, where you write a letter to love and imagine her, and I'm using her here because I believe love is a her, but you can believe love as, you know, anyone or any gender or no gender at all. And what would be the most compassionate thing that your best friend or love can write back to you for the experiences that you're having? And a lot of times for me, you know, what love writes back is that I'm doing the best I can, or that I'm doing enough, or that, you know, this is acknowledging that this is a really difficult situation. And I have talked about it in my own podcast as well recently, is just dealing with the grief of seeing someone you love go mm-hmm. through serious illness, and how to come to terms with both accepting of the disease that is happening regardless of how much you can do medically, but also doing enough that is within your power to do so that you don't feel like there's any regret.
Yeah. I was just thinking about, first of all, I love that exercise. I don't do that exercise myself, and I think I'm going to start. Secondly, you make me think of my own mother. I think we have similar stories. Both of our moms have had and have cancer. There are several times, in fact, I actually owe her a phone call, that have, popped up where something will come up medically. And even as a medical provider, understanding the system pretty well, been in the medical system for a long time now, probably longer than half of my life. And, I can't always fix the problems. And that is a frustration that comes up a lot, I think, for other caregivers too, because even with all of our knowledge, collective knowledge, we can't always fix the problem. So that can feel very frustrating. And sometimes it's just helpful to express it in some way, and even to have somebody else just to listen and say, you know, it's okay that that's happening and that you can't fix it. You know, I think sometimes the permission to just say that sucks, you know, I think sometimes we don't give ourselves that permission because we're always fixing things. We always want to fix things.
Yeah. And there's a lot of things that we cannot fix. But the good thing is that whether you are a caregiver or not, or if you're a healthcare professional, I mean, part of what we do that gives meaning and is a gift in and of itself is our presence. Mm-hmm. So I have to also remind myself that even though I'm not fixing something, I am here on this journey, whether it's with my mom or with my patients, where my presence and my witnessing of what they're going through is a gift in and of itself mm-hmm. as well. And it doesn't always feel like is as worthy or substantial as fixing the problem. But one, people may not want to fix. And two, oftentimes there is no fix. It's really just about, you know, what can we do to make the symptoms better, or what can we do to make you more comfortable, or to witness your own frustration as the person who has serious illness, so that you feel like you're heard and you're connected and you're, you know, in touch with your family and your loved ones. And there's a lot of anger too, I think, mm-hmm. or I certainly have experienced underneath that frustration, I think is a lot of anger at whether it's the system or sometimes even at my own parents for not doing the things I want them to do or not listening to my advice, whether it's a daughter or a doctor. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have to get that anger or angry energy out, and I find that exercise or some sort of movement that gets your body moving, and you don't have to think of it as exercise if you don't think of yourself as someone who likes exercise, mm-hmm. some type of movement really is helpful. I mean, I think we think a lot with our brains, but we have the rest of our bodies as well. Mm-hmm. and in medicine training and maybe in nursing training as well, it's just we're taught to really ignore what messages our bodies are telling us, mm-hmm. whether it's we're hungry or have to go to the bathroom or we're tired, you know, you're mm-hmm. just having to put all of that aside. And I think that does bleed into other areas of our lives when our bodies are telling us, giving us signals, and we're just not listening because we haven't been in the habit of listening.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And does translate over to being a caregiver too, right? Like there are symptoms that you will have when you're starting to feel overwhelmed. And it's actually we were just having this conversation that it's a matter of reconnecting with yourself, like being able to mindfully look inward and say, what is it? Why do I feel this pressure here? You know, why can't I take a deep breath right now? And just finding that moment to reconnect and then, you know, deciding, okay, what strategy could fit, you know, right now? How could I take some time in this moment to recenter or reset myself? Because you're right, like things will not, we can't fix if someone has dementia, a diagnosis of dementia, we can't fix that right now, at least at the time of this podcast. So not unless you know something I don't know. And so then, you know, how do I take control of what I can manage, you know, to care for myself? I think that's really important.
Yeah, and just to add to what you said, Rachel, about listening to our body or being aware of our body, I think even just being aware and paying attention to how it feels in our body at the time that you're having a very strong emotion. So, for example, a lot of times I feel like anger and frustration is a pressure in my chest, or even in the back of my throat. And to different people, it may be in a different place, but just kind of pausing, and it doesn't have to be very long, but pausing and just describing the feeling or the tingling of what your body is feeling to yourself, as though, you know, you're describing it to an alien who has never experienced anger or frustration before. And you can say, you know, what it feels like. Is it warm? Is it cold? Is it a particular color? You know, all of that is really so that you can observe the emotion or describe it so that you have a bit of a separation between you, the person, and the emotion you're experiencing. And a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy is related to, you know, thinking about listening, checking in with your body to see what is a thought that may be contributing to that feeling. And a lot of times, in some of the self-coaching that I've done for myself, is really it relates back to it should have been this way, or it could have been this way, or the should oftentimes is what gets me frustrated. And then I have to learn to challenge that should. Is it really, should it be that way, or is it just something that I think should be that way? And oftentimes, you know, the combination of movement and journaling can oftentimes get me out of, you know, that momentary heightened emotion. But I think the third, I guess, strategy that I oftentimes use is when you're having sort of a chronic stress, and most caregiving is a, you know, chronic stress because it's not something that you can really resolve in a day or even a week or even a month. You know, your loved one's illness stretches on for years. And I think that is where I find a regular meditation routine is really helpful in terms of relieving my own stress, as well as massage therapy. Again, something else that gets back to the body to relieve that pressure that we don't even realize we have been holding on throughout all of this. And I can tell, you know, with aches and pains, if I haven't been stretching or moving or getting a regular massage, that, you know, it does show up in my body.
Yeah, those are great tips. And I was just thinking, you know, you and I had the opportunity to even talk to some caregivers about just their journeys. And they had brought up things that would be helpful for them. And these were Black and Latino caregivers specifically. And I was just reflecting, I think, while you were talking about the power of presence and about the how many times we would hear from the interviews that we had done about the importance of listening and really being present when a caregiver is talking to you and telling you how they're experiencing their world. And I was just thinking about that in the context of even being in the healthcare system, and or not everybody who is caring for someone who has dementia or another chronic illness has good access to medical providers who have an in-depth understanding of how to navigate these systems with them. Just because you and I know there's a very significant shortage of physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs who specialize in caring for older adults. So what strategies or things, what are your reflections on that? You know, I mean, I think I kind of moved from like just talking about, you know, the interviews we had done, but also just in general, communication with healthcare providers and how we as healthcare providers can show up for people in a meaningful way.
Yeah, absolutely. So the project that Rachel mentioned is a specific project we interviewed and did focus groups for Black and Hispanic Latino caregivers for people living with dementia in our community, as well as some community organization partners who are not caregivers themselves, but work with older adults who have dementia. In the case of what these caregivers have brought up, so I'm not Black and I'm not Latino Hispanic, but I am somewhat understanding of sort of the language barrier when it comes to my mother's healthcare, in the sense that language concordant care was very important and came up multiple times for people who speak Spanish and feel like they're being a bother to ask for a translator, or that things are not communicated well because there is a need for translation. And even though my mom is fluent in conversational English, there's still a lot of issues surrounding health literacy and medical literacy, where the points that are communicated by medical professionals who are taught to communicate with each other in the medical jargon is not clear or is not transmitted well to patients who don't have that background. And then you add in additional, whether it's language barriers, cultural barriers, how you're taught to respond to people in authority. There's different generational differences in that too, as well as, you know, discrimination and racism that are either explicit or implicit in the healthcare setting. All of those kind of add as additional hurdles that minoritized populations have to deal with and in their healthcare settings, in addition to just the disease and being a caregiver and all the things that come up with that. So I think we heard a lot about people not having time with their clinicians, or not feeling like they have the opportunity to fully explain their symptoms or get answers answered. You know, it's not. And I totally believe them that this happens where things are changed, or they feel like there has been no communication about why certain procedures or interventions are done or not done. And that can really lead to mistrust that's understandable because there has been breakdowns in terms of communication. There's also additional difficulties, particularly for people who don't speak English, in terms of finding alternative paid caregivers who are language concordant, especially with people with dementia. You know, it's very difficult to, there's really no point in hiring someone who doesn't speak Spanish to care for a Spanish speaking only person with dementia, because they're not going to be able to relieve the burden of the caregiver. It's adding more to the work of the caregiver who now has to translate for the person who is coming in to try to give that caregiver a respite. So all of those things are kind of system and, you know, additional barriers that we need to work through and pay attention to. But I think if people who are listening to this who are not
Black or Hispanic, Latino, and are, you know, English is their primary language. I think just being aware that the experience of the healthcare system for people who are different from you is oftentimes much more unpleasant in various ways, whether it's intentional or not, and to really believe them and create an environment where people feel comfortable in telling you what's really going on. I routinely talk to the caregiver and the person with memory problems separately and make it a norm, because it's really, really difficult to say, well, actually, you know, my mom or whoever has been having hallucinations, because I don't want to bring that up and then cause a fight on the way home. But then the healthcare professional never actually hears about what's truly going on. And a lot of times, you know, our healthcare settings are structured where both the person with memory loss and the person who's caring for them are in the same room. So how do you transmit somewhat contentious information in a confidential manner mm-hmm. to the person who's supposed to be, you know, helping you?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I know that goes back to caregiver burden and burnout, right? So if we're not, as healthcare professionals, managing or hearing what's actually happening, how can we help manage the symptoms that might be making life a little bit harder than it has to be for somebody who's caring for a person that has cognitive impairment. So I think that's a really good point. Are there any resources or any outside of your podcast, which is amazing, any other resources that you recommend to people regularly when they're caring for their, you know, I say loved ones, but it's not always loved ones. And when they're caring for somebody who has dementia or another chronic illness, do you have resources that you kind of go to or suggest?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one useful resource is the UCLA caregiver education videos. And if you just Google, you know, UCLA caregiver dementia, you'll find a whole series of very short videos that kind of talks through some common but challenging situations like refusing to bathe, refusing to take medications. And these are just a couple minute videos that kind of go through a scenario and basically coach you or show you sort of in an alternative communication manner to hopefully try on your loved one in terms of helping them take their medicine or take a bath. And those are oftentimes some of the most challenging things for a caregiver to deal with. And people with dementia, it's not the memory itself, but it's really all the neuropsychiatric symptoms that are associated with dementia. So I think if you like videos, that's a great way. If you like paper and reading, probably the most commonly recommended book is this one called Creating Moments of Joy Along the Alzheimer's Journey by Jolene Bracke. And the reason why I recommend this one versus some of the other ones is that it's divided into very short paragraphs. And I think it brings in some, you know, just dark humor in terms of what you have to deal with a person with dementia. And we have given out this book as part of a research study to thank the participants, and have gotten a lot of great feedback from actual caregivers who, you know, understandably are very stressed and, you know, may not be able to have the attention to sit through a prolonged explanation of what the different types of dementias might be. Although some people are really into that, but most people are, you know, just trying to, yeah, just tell me what I need. I'll flip through the chapter that says bathing and just read a couple of pages, and that's all I can do right now.
Yeah.
So that's one book, and all of these books are I think around $15-$20 on Amazon, so not terribly expensive. And then there are a number of video audio options as well. Appreciate you mentioning my podcast, which I do a whole series of different episodes related to dementia as well as, you know, caregiving. But there are also other podcasts out there for people who like hearing about the brain. And there is Dementia Matters, which is put out by the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. That one is also interviewed by a geriatrician who interviews, that's probably a little bit more scientific and research focused, but for people who are kind of interested in knowing the latest trends and things related to memory research, I think that's a good one to do. But I think those are probably the top recommendations in terms of additional resources. And I think, you know, because there are so much information, sometimes people are stuck in information overload. I would say it probably doesn't matter which one, as long as you just pick one and, you know, go with it and, you know, spend 5-10 minutes and not worry too much about finding the perfect resource because it's going to be different for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really helpful. And there's a ton of information out there. And those are all really great resources. And I like the Creating Moments of Joy too, because there's mm-hmm. embedded in there, which I think can sometimes get lost in the minutia of the long illnesses.
Right. Right. Yeah. And Deepa Snow, who is an occupational therapist who has her own description of different levels of dementia patients and calling them different gems. Mm-hmm. I think that's another positive way of kind of understanding behavior and what people are trying to communicate when people have lost the ability to really communicate. So I think there are many different ways of helping interpret what the person with dementia is trying to say when they don't have necessarily the verbal abilities to say it in the way that they used to be able to say it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Well, thank you. This has been great.
Thank you.
So is there anything else that you want to leave listeners with? Any advice or no?
I think probably is really just pick one thing that you're going to do for yourself today. And it doesn't have to be anything very big or take a long time. But sometimes I trick myself into exercising if I say, well, I'm just going to do 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then I inevitably spend longer than 10 minutes exercising. But it's sort of a mind trick to tell myself to do things that are good for me, but may take a little bit of convincing to do because it's hard. And things like, you know, say journaling or meditation for people who are not used to doing those things can also feel overwhelming to start. But I would say just pick something that seems doable to you and do it for 5 to 10 minutes. And that's better than nothing at all.
Yeah, I like that. And even with the mindfulness meditation practices, I like now that there are a lot of free resources, especially on YouTube, where you mm-hmm. can just do something guided. You don't have to figure it out by yourself. There are resources.
Right. And last point, I think from a music perspective, there is a series of songs on Spotify. And I listened to this, it's called Brain Spotting, where there's kind of mm-hmm. bilateral sounds. And it's by David Grand, PhD. These are mostly sounds of like ocean and rain. And it does have a scientific basis in the sense that when you have bilateral stimulus, whether it's music or visual stuff, it helps reduce stimulation to the amygdala, which is part of our brain that sort of controls fight or flight. So sometimes when I am very stressed out, I would drive home and put in my ear pods and listen to the brain spotting music just as a way of calming down my inner fight. Yeah. It's usually not flight. It's usually inner fight.
That's me too. Yeah. I actually use brain spotting, and I'm glad you brought that up because it's also free and it's not something that people really know about. And mm-hmm. it is pretty effective. I have underlying anxiety, and that is, I can put that, my little AirPods in, and within a couple minutes feel calmer mm-hmm. just because of the back and forth.
Yeah. Also, you know, crossing your arms and giving yourself hugs or having mm-hmm. some sort of bilateral tactile stimulation oftentimes mm-hmm. can be really helpful as well. Obviously, yeah. You can't do that when you're driving.
Yeah. And to that point, that's why walking is helpful.
Yes.
Right?
Like, yeah. When you're looking on both sides, you know, uh-huh. looking at the trees or being in nature. Yeah. There's quite a lot of scientific studies that say, you know, being in nature is good for your brain and helps with your mood. So it's just like 7 degrees today.
So maybe not today. Maybe not today.
Maybe not today when the pollen is super bad.
Yeah. I feel like we're getting too geeky. This is us in normal life. Like we... just start talking about geeky things. But yes, so thank you again, Mia. This is great. And I can't wait to let our listeners listen to it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Hey, everybody. I hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Mia as much as I did. Her insights into dementia care and the challenges that care partners face are pretty enlightening, if I must say so myself. It's really challenging to be a caregiver for someone who has a chronic illness, and I'm really grateful for the valuable advice and resources that she shared with us today. So before I sign off, I wanted to highlight some of the fantastic resources that Dr. Mia had mentioned during the discussion. For those of you who are caring for loved ones who have dementia, the UCLA caregiver education videos are an excellent tool. These are tools that I've actually recommended to my own patients who are caregivers of people who have dementia, and I've used them myself because my own grandmother has dementia, and sometimes I need to be reminded on some strategies to help. They're short videos, and they have a lot of practical advice for how to handle common but sometimes really challenging situations like refusing to bathe or trouble with taking medications or maybe some delusions or hallucinations. And another valuable resource is a book called Creating Moments of Joy Along the Alzheimer's Journey by Jolene Brackley. It's a really great book because it has short, accessible paragraphs. You can kind of skip around in the book. It's humorous. And let's face it, if you're a caregiver or someone who has a chronic illness, you need a little humor in your life. So I just wanted to recommend those books. And then also, if you like podcasts, don't miss Dr. Mia's own show called Ask Dr. Mia, where she explores aging well and the complexities of geriatric medicine. There's another podcast called Dementia Matters, and it's a podcast that's produced by the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and it's also a fantastic resource that will help you stay on top of the latest trends in research and memory care if that's something you are interested in. Dr. Mia also introduced us to the idea of brain spotting music on Spotify. This is something I use myself. It's bilateral auditory stimulation. It's really great for concentration, reducing stress. I use it to calm my mind when I'm feeling anxious. And I think, you know, it's free. So what else could you want? Also, I just want to thank you for tuning in to the Huguenurse podcast. If you enjoy the episode, please subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your friends. Your support helps us reach more people and continue to bring enriching content. And lastly, I would love to remind you about our digital courses that are available now online at the Huguenurse or Huga Abode website. These courses are designed to help you declutter your home based on your personality type, also provide some really practical insights on how to create spaces that promote your well-being. So visit us at our website. It's linked in the show notes for more information. And until next time, please keep nourishing your body, your mind, your spirit, and stay cozy and connected. And goodbye for now, friends.